Hey guys, I've got a great new company and product to share with you. Now I know that, like me, many of you are beard men. So let me tell you about the Luxurious Bastards Company. The owner is David, and his company makes some amazing products. But of course, the beard oil and butter is just amazing. All of David's oils are hand-mixed and made in small batches, hand-poured by David himself. Now this isn't a company that's run by some executive in a mansion, depending on a fancy marketing scheme. He's a beard man, just like us. The base oil list is impressive. Sweet almond oil, avocado oil, rice bran oil, hazelnut oil, hemp seed oil, apricot oil, castor oil, as well as sunflower seed oil, cold pressed grapeseed oil, jojoba oil, argan oil, vitamin E, and an amazing luxurious essential oil blend. Your beard has never smelled better. Right now, I am loving 1886 with a scent profile of dry Cuban tobacco leaf, tobacco blossoms, dry spices, tonka bean, fresh vanilla, cocoa, dried fruit, cedar wood, and sandalwood. It smells amazing, and your beard will thank you for it. David also has combs, brushes, scissors, even products for that special lady in your life. So head over to luxuriousbastardco.com and use coupon code American10 for 10% off each and every single order. That's coupon code American10 for 10% off each and every single order. Just go to www.luxuriousbastardco.com or follow the link in our show notes page and get started today. Okay, let's get back to the show. The American History Podcast, Season 4, Episode 33, World War II in China, Part 2.
This is Tokyo Road. Are you listening? All you fine boys in your comfortable foxhole, listen closely.
Okay, welcome back to the show. Now, last time, we spent some time looking at China in the late 1930s as the Japanese increased their pressure on the nationalist government. We saw, in its desperation, that government make the decision to break the dikes that held the Yellow River in check. The fallout from this fateful decision would haunt Chiang Kai-shek in the future. But at the time, the world believed him and his government when they blamed the Japanese. And this is where we will continue our narrative. Now, of course, that means that we need to head back in time to China in the mid-1930s. The song of the week is The Tune of the Nightingales by Yi Yingqiu. We'll see you in just a moment. Now, as 1938 came to an end, things looked pretty dark for the Chinese. The three major parties in the war, the Nationalists, the Communists, and the Japanese, all settled in for a long war. It was clear China was not going to simply collapse and allow itself to be absorbed by the Japanese Empire. It was also clear the Japanese were not about to simply give up. From the outside, it appeared the situation had stabilized, but that was far from the case. As noted by historian Rana Mitter, China was virtually alone, and there was no way it could depend on or expect help to arrive from outside. Perhaps saying it was alone is a bit of hyperbole, as you'll see in this episode. But I will say that, in the end, China would have to provide the majority of the manpower while she had help. The help was not anywhere close to what the Chinese would like to have received. While the first year saw the war in its offensive and highly mobile phase, it was now settling down into a defensive war. Going forward, China now depended on a set of shifting alliances, diplomatic intrigues, and social changes that would alter the country forever. Now, in our last episode, we briefly mentioned Mao and the Communist Party. And now it is, I think, time to return our attention to them. One question that came to mind was what had Mao been up to as the war broke out? From the years 1937 to 1940, Mao was looking to solidify his control of the Chinese Communist Party. One man who could challenge his leadership was Chiang Kuo-to. Now, Chiang had an army of about 80,000 soldiers, and he had the credentials to become leader of the party. As a matter of fact, because his army was eight times the size of Mao's battered force, one might have made the argument that he was in a far better position to lead the Communist Party. He had studied in the Soviet Union during the 1920s, and he was a key Chinese member of the Comintern, the Communist International. And while they met up in the summer of 1935, there can be no doubt that Chiang Kao-tao wanted to be rid of Mao. He plotted to have Mao arrested when they disagreed about the best way forward. Mao preferred to move north to the communist base in Shaanxi, while Chiang thought it would be best to move into Sichuan, a region populated by ethnic minorities. In the end, Mao escaped, and Chiang ended up losing about 50% of his forces. Now, when he himself finally arrived in the north in 1936, Chiang Kuo-tao was without a doubt the junior partner. But Mao wasn't done. Mao needed the Red Army to try and open the way to Russian arms supplies near Mongolia. And he designated Chiang's forces as the ones to try and break through the nationalists who were in the way. After Chiang's forces were trapped, Mao tasked them with the challenging mission of reconnecting with the Russians, situated 1,500 kilometers away at the periphery of Xinjiang, another region under Soviet control. Unfortunately, a vehemently anti-communist Muslim army blocked their path. I think you can see where this was going. Mao was purposely whittling down his rival's forces, and by early 1937, things were so bad that the forces asked to be withdrawn. Instead, Mao demanded that they, quote, fight to the last person and to the last drop of blood, end quote. Here we see just how ruthless Mao was, and it was a sign of what was in store for the Chinese people once Mao took control in 1949. Oh, but never fear. As I said earlier, Mao was not done yet. When Chiang Kuo-tao's forces were eliminated, this gave Mao the excuse he needed to end Chiang's ability to challenge for party leadership once and for all. While the Soviets still supplied Chiang, Mao turned him into the scapegoat, and he was denounced in front of his own officers. Mao not only ended his leadership prospects, but he had murdered the few members of Kuo-tao's army who made it back. One source reports, quote, when they were chased into our area, we first of all gave them a welcome party and took over their arms. Then we said to them, comrades, you have been through a lot. You were transferred to the rear to have a good rest. We took them in batches into the valleys and buried all these grandsons of turtles, that's a euphemism for bastards, alive. It was such fun burying them. At first we said to them, with smiles, comrades, dig the pits well. We want to bury nationalist troops alive. They worked really hard, one spade after another, wiping sweat from their faces. After they finished, we shoved them and kicked them all in. At first, they thought we were joking. But when we began to shovel earth in, they started shouting, comrades, we are not nationalist troops. We cursed sons of bitches. We don't care whether you're nationalist troops or not. We want you to die, and you die, end quote. I have no words to describe just how evil this was. But as we've seen, Chinese society in the 1930s was, to put it mildly, violent. Now, as you can imagine, all of this eventually caused Kuo-tao to leave the Communist Party and join the Nationalists. Warned not to burn his bridges with the CCP, Kuo-tao did not give up any of the secrets he held. And surely he held many secrets, seeing as how he was high up in the CCP and in charge of planting spies inside of the Nationalist Party, to whom he was a disappointment. Indeed, he was at least respected enough that, in the mid-1950s, his sons were allowed to return to China and attend university. Chiang Kuo-tao had fled China right before Mao took over all of it in 1949, and while Mao had him expelled and discredited, there was at least enough respect there that the disdain did not extend to his offspring. Now, in these first few years of the war, Mao had settled into isolation in Yan'an province and took advantage of the situation to educate himself on Marxist literature and philosophy. Despite being a voracious reader for his entire life, it wasn't until Mao stopped running that he had the opportunity to thoroughly explore the ideology he had adopted during his youth. Unlike Chiang Kuo-tao, Mao could not claim to have been an important member of the Comintern or to have traveled to Moscow to study under Stalin. Now, furthermore, while individuals like Zhou Enlai and the party possessed higher levels of refinement and formal education, Mao had never undergone formal Marxist education, despite his unquestionable intellect. This led to doubts regarding his training and comprehension of Marxist theory. As per one historian, Mao's objective was to enhance his grip on the ideological domain of leadership and consequently hold his hold over the party. It is conceivable that Mao, being from a rural background, may have faced some intimidation when encountering individuals who had traveled to places like Russia and received education in Moscow, particularly under the tutelage of someone like Stalin. This may have caused Mao to feel somewhat insecure about his own level of education and knowledge. In 1938, Wang Ming was the only obstacle between Mao and complete dominance over the CCP. The contest between the two was emblematic of the broader struggle between the Soviet Union via the Comintern and the CCP to dictate the future path of the Chinese Revolution. And so this is where it gets interesting. As the Chinese nationalists were fighting for their lives and doing everything possible to stop the Japanese advance, Mao and the communists were busy fighting amongst themselves. It did not go unnoticed. In Moscow, the leader of the Comintern, Georgi Dmitriev, suggested to Wang Jiaxiang, known as the Red Professor, that the Chinese Communist Party needed to get its act together. According to one historian, Dmitriev said, quote, "The CCP needed to solve its problems under the leadership headed by Mao Zedong," end quote. That was this line, "under the leadership," that would be used by Mao to strengthen his position, as you'll see in a minute. In the meantime, Wang himself was fighting against the Japanese, and when Mao called for a Central Committee plenary session to, in his words, hear the instructions they had received from the Comintern, Wang objected. Just in case you were wondering, a plenum or a plenary session is a meeting of a deliberative body where all members are present. This is different from a quorum, which is when a minimal number of members are present. Finally, the Red Professor messaged Wang and threatened him, quote, "Obey the center or else," end quote. Not wanting to find out what the "or else" was, Wang made his way to HQ. The Red Professor was the first to address the Politburo, quoting Dmitriev and his, quote, "leadership under Mao" statement. This led Mao to say he was to deliver the political report, and it solidified him as the de facto ruler of the CCP. Wang offered no objections, and when the party plenum opened, the Red Professor once again quoted Dmitriev. In the minds of the CCP's high command, Moscow expected and endorsed the idea that Mao was the leader of the Communist Party in China. For supporting him, Mao rewarded the Red Professor with several key posts, as well as a beautiful young wife. And, of course, Mao set about to destroy the reputation of Wang, which he successfully did. Wang would hold a variety of minor and insignificant posts, and eventually left China for the Soviet Union in the mid-1950s. Now, I should mention one other fact that makes this plenum of major importance in Chinese history and the history of the CCP. This is the moment when Mao revealed his true intentions. Previously, the policy had been to play nice with the nationalists. In fact, previously, he had called Chiang Kai-shek a great leader and wanted communists to avoid fights with nationalists. However, now he told the top men in the party that, in fact, the ultimate enemy was the Generalissimo and the nationalists. They were to prepare now to seize power from him and strike out at nationalist troops when they stood in the way of communist expansion. Now, surprisingly, the city of Yan'an served as a notable symbol of extreme opposition during this period, and thus drew a considerable number of migrants. Although the influx of people was not as substantial as those who had fled to Chongqing, around 50% of those who did arrive in Yan'an had received education. A significant portion of them were journalists, teachers, and students. They were motivated by the belief that China required a fresh vision for the future, given the nationalists, in their view, abominable conduct before 1937. All of this benefited Mao, as he had a middle-class group to draw upon and to use to his purposes. It also meant he had fewer refugees to deal with, a situation that plagued the nationalist government and surely made them appear ineffective. Now, another advantage that the communists had was that while they faced attacks from the anti-communist Japanese, the Japanese focused on Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist regime. Chiang's resistance served as a symbol to both a domestic and international audience that China was not going to surrender easily to Japanese aggression. The communists, however, were able to develop their agenda without any external monitoring or interference. There were no foreign embassies present in Yan'an, and although foreigners occasionally visited, they were few in number. Moreover, those who did come were often radical journalists sympathetic to communism, such as Edgar Snow, who provided a favorable depiction of the situation in Yunnan. Now, from 1937 to 1941, which marked the early years of the war, the CCP experienced an astonishing growth in party membership. The party's number of members grew from around 40,000 to nearly 800,000, and the size of the army increased from approximately 92,000 soldiers to 500,000. This was partly because the communists permitted local militias in the territories under their control to split their time between farming duties and military service. This arrangement lessened the worry of families losing their young men to the army and depriving them of a source of income. One could compare this to the nationalist areas, where there is a clear difference. In the latter, the fear of losing a father and/or a husband to the war was very real. In the end, I believe this is just one reason the CCP was able to defeat the Kuomintang, the Nationalist Party, in the long run. It was able to effectively run the areas it ruled, most of which were in the countryside, while the Nationalists were busy struggling to defeat the Japanese and trying to create a government at the same time. In other words, the Nationalists were trying to build the airplane and fly it at the same time. By 1939, fighting had broken out between the Communists and the Nationalists. This was problematic, as the Russians were supporting both sides against Japan. Indeed, it was the Soviets who truly kept the Chinese in the war against Japan in those early years, not the Americans. The standard narrative is that the United States acted as the arsenal of democracy against the fascists in Europe and Asia. Which is true, but not at first, and certainly not in Asia. Remember, the U.S. Congress had passed the Neutrality Acts, which made it illegal for the government to support any one side in a conflict. Thus, the Russians were the ones helping the Chinese. Now, Russian aid to the Nationalist government of China was much more than one might believe. In 1939 alone, they loaned over $300 million to the government. That is over $6 billion in today's money. They were also giving advice and assistance to Mao's people, but the majority of their help went to Chiang Kai-shek's Nationalist government. For example, from 1937 to 1941, Russia sent over 1,200 airplanes, 1,600 pieces of artillery, more than 14,000 machine guns, 50,000 rifles, 2,000 pilots, and 30,000 engineers. Russian pilots were flying out of Nanjing, Wuhan, Chongqing, Chengdu, Lanzhou, Xi'an, and other cities to fight against the Japanese on behalf of the Chinese. Over 200 Russian pilots were killed fighting for the Chinese, and without Russian aid and assistance, it is very likely the Chinese would have been forced out of the war. That's not to say that the Western allies, i.e. Britain and the United States, did nothing. They did what they could, but Britain had squandered the majority of its blood and treasure in the fields of France in World War I, and the United States, as I already mentioned, was intent on remaining neutral. The Americans did extend loans and would eventually send more aid, more of that in a few minutes. But the British also extended a small loan. However, they also responded by building the Burma Road. Now, this road connected Kunming, Yunnan, to the railhead in Lashiao, Burma, which at that point was a part of the British Empire. This allowed the British to provide much-needed, if limited, aid to the Chinese up through 1942, at which point the Japanese shut it down once and for all. Most, if not all, of this fighting was behind the Japanese lines, where a number of communist bases sprung up. There was a base in Jianchaji, which was about 80 kilometers outside of Beijing and eventually controlled a population of 25 million people. Now, while the communists in China praised Mao and his cold policies, he knew how to play to his audience. When Russian emissaries came from Stalin, he was sure to do things like have a book by Stalin open in the study. He toasted Stalin and spoke longingly of his desire to travel nowhere else except to Moscow. I guess you could say Mao, at least at this point, knew how to kiss up and play the game. Now, we should note that Stalin and the Comintern believed in a policy in China which called for Mao and the communists to support Chiang Kai-shek's leadership and assist with the war against Japan. This, as far as Stalin was concerned, was the main priority. Remember, Stalin and the Soviets were supporting both sides in China, at least to a limited extent. Whenever reports made their way to Moscow of fighting between the two sides, Mao was always quick to lay the blame at the feet of the Nationalists. Now, on the other hand, there was Zhou Enlai, perhaps the second most important figure in the CCP, up until the 1970s, second only to Mao, a man who supported Mao from the mid-1930s until his death in the early 1970s. He agreed with Chiang Kai-shek in his proposal in 1940 that the Red Army should concentrate its efforts north of the Yangtze River. The point was to avoid internal fights between the two sides. Further, Chiang worded his suggestion as an order, and Zhou was on board with it. The two men were attempting to keep the united front going, but Mao did not agree. He wanted the communists to continue operating south of the Yangtze, even though Chiang's plan gave the CCP control of China north of the Yangtze all the way to the Soviet Union. As we can see, it would never be enough for Mao. For him, it was all or nothing. Now, in the fall of 1940, Mao's armies, having grown to an impressive size, moved to attack the Japanese. This was a departure from their previous policy of avoiding the Japanese for fear of punitive attacks. Mao ordered a coordinated attack against rail lines, major highways, coal mines, and other infrastructure that was in the hands of the Japanese. This attack, while successful, led to the death of 20,000 Chinese troops, while the Japanese only lost about 3,000 to 4,000. Any territory lost by the Imperial Army was retaken with a ruthless efficiency. They also implemented an infamous, quote, kill all, burn all, destroy all, end quote, policy, which meant killing all civilians, including women and children, as well as livestock. They destroyed buildings, burned crops, and dikes and canals were also destroyed. It was total war, 20th century style. Now, speaking of the 20th century, if you'd like to support the show and get at least 40 hours of bonus content, honestly, I stopped counting, so it's probably way more, on things like the Cold War and the War on Terrorism, head over to our Patreon and join up. For as little as $10 a month, you'll have access to each and every bonus show. And right now, we have two, one for $5 a month, and then one that is for the folks at the $10 level. The first is a continuation of the Colonial America series that kicked off the show way back when. Now, if you didn't know, that series only had about 10 episodes or so, and they've all been moved over to Patreon. Well, I'm continuing that series and taking it up to at least George Washington's administration. And for the people at the $10 a month level, they get that plus the show on American involvement in the Middle East, plus a lot of other stuff, like the show 1983, the year the world almost ended. So head over to patreon.com/American History and support the show. Thank you so much for that. Now let's get back to the narrative. Okay, so a question I've had as I was reading and writing these episodes on China was, what was the effect of the Molotov-Ribbentrop non-aggression pact? What did it have on the Chinese, on the war in China? I mean, the communists and the fascists were mortal enemies. But suddenly the world's largest communist country signs a non-aggression pact with the most powerful fascist nation? Japan was hopeful that the demise of the anti-communist attitude in Berlin and Rome meant that the Soviets, with whom they were attempting a detente, would end their aid to the Chinese. Now, the Japanese, in late September 1939, signed the Tripartite Pact with Hitler and Mussolini. Now, for his part, Chiang Kai-shek reminded his senior officers that he had predicted, as early as 1934, that such a development would lead the Japanese Empire to expand south. This meant they would eventually collide with the United States, Great Britain, and France. Chiang argued that this development gained Japan nothing. Instead, he believed this put Japan on a collision course with powerful enemies, countries who would now be natural allies for the Chinese.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm Michael Sievers, the writer, producer, and creator of The Silver King's War, a podcast series about my father's Second World War as a B-26 bombardier. Stanley L. Silverfield, a first lieutenant in the United States Army Air Corps from Birmingham, Alabama, rode in the nose, the greenhouse of the famed Martin Marauder. You can find The Silver King's War wherever you listen to podcasts.
And now, finally, the United States enters the story. Now, I'm sure you've been wondering when that would happen. Chiang, always on the lookout for an ally of some sort, or perhaps just an advantage, sent peace feelers to Tokyo. This was done unofficially, but of course, he made sure the Americans found out about it. This worried President Franklin D. Roosevelt, for if the Japanese were able to come to a peaceful conclusion to the war in China, that would free up at least half of their army for operations elsewhere. And by this point, Roosevelt was convinced that the war in the Pacific was not far from becoming a reality. In fact, FDR had given some help to the Chinese in the late 1930s. After the Chinese invaded, Cheng had asked the Americans for 500 bombers. Now, the president could not give that many, but he did send 66 Lockheed Hudson and Douglas DB-7s to the Chinese. He also loaned them 100 P-40 Tomahawk pursuit aircraft, which were to be flown by American crews. These became known popularly as the Flying Tigers. As author Craig Nelson notes in V for Victory, FDR was exploring ways to combat fascists, or to involve the United States in the business of others, depending on your point of view, as early as 1937. Now, of course, the president had broken American law by authorizing this, and the secret was kept just that, a classified secret for 50 years. Remember, the Neutrality Acts meant the president was not supposed to be doing any of this. FDR also found a way to get the Kuomintang government a line of credit for $100 million. Now, we will leave off the American story there, at least for now. In the meantime, in October 1939, the Communists' new Fourth Army teamed up with units of the 8th Route Army to attack the Nationalists' 89th Army, killing the commander and capturing thousands of soldiers. Now, both sides blamed the other, but the fact remains this is more evidence that both sides, in the end, saw the other as the long-term enemy. Mao, as was his usual method, informed Stalin and Dmitriev and warned that he believed this was further proof Chiang wanted not only to make a separate peace deal with the Japanese, but that he was more interested in taking away the gains made by the Communist Party than he was with defeating the enemy. Dmitriev disagreed with Mao's assessment and said as much in a full reply to the Chinese Communist leader. He said it was most important for the CCP to not initiate action against the central government. Now, in the end, Mao complied with the orders from Chiang Kai-shek, but he also provoked an attack. The chairman, in a radio communication, advised his commander, Chiang, to act quickly. Soon after, General Gu Zhutan informed Chiang that Chiang's forces had launched an attack on the 44th Division. It is likely the message was encoded to provoke a response, which is precisely what occurred. Chiang resolved to demonstrate his resolve to terminate the Communist Party of China's unapproved military expansion, ordered a counterattack. He believed that it was necessary to discipline those who could not comply with orders. The result was what turned out to be a Pyrrhic victory for the Nationalists. They captured 9,000 Communist soldiers, including the commander, Xiang Ying. However, this ended up angering the average person and fanned the flames of popular sympathy for the CCP. Mao's right-hand man, Zhou Enlai, had his PR machine kick into high gear, and soon newspapers all over the country, including the Communist New China Daily, published in Chongqing, started blaming the Generalissimo, Chiang Kai-shek, for what they termed to be a bloody act of treachery, one that saw Chinese fighting Chinese at a time in the nation's history which was most critical. It was at this time that the real plan for the Japanese Empire revealed itself through a stroke of ill luck for the enemy. The plane of the commander-in-chief of the Japanese South Fleet crashed over China. In that plane were the plans, which were recovered and turned over to the Allies for the forthcoming attack by the Japanese in the South China Sea and Southeast Asia. It was now quite clear that they had given up on the idea of subduing China. Japan was now clearly headed towards a war with Great Britain and the United States. Thus, in 1941, when Congress passed FDR's Lend-Lease Act, China was included and eventually received $1.6 billion, or about 3% of the total. Not enough to help it defeat Japan, but just enough to make sure she stayed in the war. So, this was the situation in the winter of 1939 through 40, when the Nationalists launched the Winter Offensive. This was a massive counterattack, which included some 80 divisions in the southern area of Shanxi and along the Yangtze, where it poured out into the South China Sea. Here, the Japanese were threatening Sichuan. However, and this should now come as no surprise, the general in charge of the Nationalist forces, Warlord Yan Xishan, decided to cut a deal with the Japanese in return for weapons. He then used these to attack not the Japanese, but the Communist 8th Route Army. Now, if you're starting to think the two sides, the Nationalists and the Communists, were their own worst enemy in this conflict, I think you might be right. Anyway, the result of all of this was that while the communists were being attacked by some of the nationalists, others were, in fact, fighting the Japanese. The Battle of Kunlun Pass, an attempt by the Chinese to ensure supply routes between Indochina and themselves remained open, was a success. It was actually quite successful. Chiang's forces were able not only to kill the Japanese major general in charge of the enemy, one Nakamura Masao, but they also destroyed his most elite unit. Now, as the war dragged on, things never improved for the Japanese. In 1940, they launched a major offensive towards the Yangtze Gorges, which were the gateway to Sichuan and Chongqing. The campaign was a failure, as the Nationalist Army was about to halt their advance. It did, however, cost the Chinese control of much of Hunan, an important source of rice production, and the number of troops they lost were high, 50,000 dead. Furthermore, a pattern began to emerge. The Japanese would take an area, but as soon as their main units departed, the Chinese forces would return. Now, after war broke out in Europe, there was hope for the Japanese. France fell in June 1940, and they began to place pressure on the British to close the Burma Road. It did indeed close, only to open up again in 1942. It was then shut down in the spring of 1942 and would remain closed until early 1945. This was bad news for Chiang, and it put him in the worst possible position he had been in since the conflagration began in 1937. It was at this point that, indeed, the Chinese were pretty much alone. Or were they? The Japanese made a major mistake in 1941, launching three offensives, all of which were major failures. First, the Battle of the Southern Hunan gained them no territory. Second, you had the Battle of Shingao, which saw the Japanese army lose 50% of its forces there. Then finally, there was the Battle of Southern Shanxi. This was a success insofar as it caused the Nationalists to withdraw. However, it also led to North and Central China being opened up to infiltration by the Communists. Historian S.C.M. Paynes notes, quote, "In doing so, Japan inadvertently relieved the Nationalist blockade of the main Communist base areas, a strategic blunder. Russia, Britain, and the United States responded to Japanese advances by intervening ever more aggressively. Japan's fixation on the regional war and the operational level of warfare, without consideration to the civil war and the brewing global war, made strategic victory, the restoration of prosperity and stability to Asia, ever more unlikely." End quote. Now, one aspect to all of this that I touched on or mentioned last time, but I've avoided it in this episode, is the use of guerrilla warfare. Now, I'm always amazed at how major armies, especially in the 20th century, fail to recognize this as a tool which must be reckoned with. Again, referring to historian S.C.M. Paine, this is the weapon favored by the weak. And the Chinese nationalists were the weaker party, at least compared to the Japanese, and when viewed from a Western military standpoint. As early as May 1938, Stalin advised Chiang Kai-shek, through his representative, and who happened to be the son of Sun Yat-sen, Sun Fo, that the Nationalists needed to enlist the entire Chinese population in a war behind the lines using partisans. The problem was that Chiang, trained in Western-style warfare in Japanese military academies, wanted to fight conventional textbook campaigns. His troops, however, had neither the training nor the tools to do that. They were, however, quite capable of waging an insurgency. The man who came up with the plan that essentially combined both strategies was the brilliant Nationalist general Bai Chongji. He argued they ought to combine guerrilla attacks with more conventional mobile operations. This would allow them to win small victories, which would help Chinese morale while, at the same time, eating away at the Japanese esprit de corps. Chiang agreed, and by the end of the decade, the Nationalists had almost 1 million guerrilla units in Japanese-occupied territory, and they made life miserable for their enemy. Furthermore, Chiang reorganized the country in 10 war zones, and instead of focusing on positional warfare, quote, in the defense of cities, end quote, he changed their goal. Now they were attempting to strike at the heart of Japanese morale and cause the erosion of Japanese forces. As we have seen in many other situations, Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan, to just name three, this switch in tactics on the part of the Nationalists proved deadly for the Japanese. They wanted to fight a conventional war, but they also had to deal with the insurgency, and it's impossible to do both simultaneously. All of this, had the Americans been paying attention, would have told them quite a bit about the war that was coming, a war for which they were already planning. However, they were not paying close attention, and the majority of Americans, even in the War Department, weren't. Had they done so, some of the lessons learned from, say, Guadalcanal, would have been apparent. The idea that the Imperial Army was rigid and led by men who were not exactly into tactics would have been pretty apparent. If the Americans had been paying attention, they would have noticed the Japanese focused on spirit and expected their troops to simply win because, in their minds, they were better. The fact that the Japanese were having such a difficult time should have made the Americans want to fund the Chinese effort even more vigorously. Okay, well, that's all I've got for you for today. Next time, we will continue to analyze China before we move on to see what was going on, actually in Burma. Until then, you've been listening to Season 4, Episode 33 of the American History Podcast, and I'll see you all next time.
Wandering, who is
shut it off or I'll rip.
Oh, Pete, where do I get it?
Wait a minute. Your fault.